Hi everybody, welcome to another Storage Unpacked podcast. This week I'm joined by Gavin. Hi Gavin.
Hi Chris, how are you doing?
I'm good. Good to have you back on the podcast. And this week we're also joined by a guest. We're joined by Zivin Ori from E8 Storage. Hi Zivin.
Hi Chris, hi Gavin.
Good evening.
So Zivin, would you like just to give a little bit of an introduction about yourself for the audience? I know you're CEO of the company, but it would be great if you could just give a little bit of background.
Sure. So by way of background, I got into the world of enterprise storage exactly 10 years ago, which sounds a lot to me, but I guess for some folks in the enterprise storage space, it's a short while. I managed IBM's XFV storage development for 5 years. When I joined that team, it was 13 people, and I grew that team to over 100 people. At the same time, the revenues of XFV grew from $5 million a year when I joined to about $400 million a year. So it was a very exciting time and a school for building enterprise storage. A lot of those lessons and things we saw at customers' data centers, we carried over to E8 Storage when we founded E8 3 years ago.
Okay, excellent. So let's just set the context for this podcast. Previously, we talked about the idea of disaggregated storage. And by that, we meant the idea that rather than have a centralized controller or infrastructure, that we're seeing architectures that actually disaggregate or separate out the actual data path and the management and the control path, if you like, so that you have direct contact between a client and, in this instance and in many instances, NVMe drives. And that's done really to try and get the benefit out of the NVMe drives in terms of IOPS and throughput and so on. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about it in a bit more detail with somebody who's an expert on the line rather than the three of us as it was last time ranting around about this subject. And we'll talk about exactly how E8 storage platform actually addresses this. So Zivin, why don't you kick us off and just talk about this change in architecture and why we see this as being a good direction for the future of technology, especially with NVMe.
Sure. So I think that the notion of disaggregating the storage data path from the control path had some inklings with the parallel NFS, but as long as the performance was performance of hard drives and performance of SAS connected SSDs, the tension between carrying everything in traditional storage controllers was not that abrupt as when NVMe drives came to market. And NVMe drives provide something like a 10 times performance improvement in terms of bandwidth and IOPS compared to existing SAS and SATA SSDs, and far lower latency. And today, a single NVMe drive, and my laptop actually contains one, outperforms a 24 SSD all-flash array from tier one vendors. And this contrast is because of the performance of NVMe drives and what is becoming the bottleneck in the traditional all-flash array architecture, even though traditional just means 5 years old, but that is becoming the bottleneck is the architecture of the all-flash array itself, which constrains all of the traffic through a pair of controllers behind which lie those 24 SSDs. And we've identified this bottleneck a little over 3 years ago, and that is what triggered us to start E8 Storage as a solution to this very problem.
You've got obviously a very good high-end laptop, which if it's got an NVMe drive in, pretty nice. Give us an idea, if you can, if we can talk numbers here, because I would say, you know, are we talking latencies of microseconds here? But just to give the audience an understanding, and how many IOPS are we talking that NVMe drives can do over, you know, traditional SSDs?
You know, the three traditional performance metrics are bandwidth and IOPS and latency. In all three of them, NVMe shines and outperforms SAS and SATA by a considerable margin. If we look at IOPS, the SAS enterprise-grade drives do about 50,000 or 70,000 IOPS per second. A single NVMe drive can do 10 times that, about 700,000 IOPS per second on a single drive. If you're trying to build a box, which is very common for storage enclosures, something like 24 drives, you just do the math, you're north of 10 million IOPS, which is dramatically higher than what today's all-flash arrays do, which is something around 200 or 300 or 500,000 IOPS per second. So a dual controller 24 SSD all-flash array today, which can cost you an arm and a leg, will do less IOPS per second than a single NVMe drive. And just for reference, my laptop, it's an ordinary laptop. That's what they come equipped with today. It's an M.2 drive, which is really NVMe. And I think that's an important thing because it shows that one, NVMe drives are taking over the consumer landscape as well, which always leads to economies of scale when it comes to components. So it means that for enterprise storage and data center storage, the componentry becomes cheaper. But two, that people are enjoying this kind of performance. When people ask me who needs NVMe drives, I'm like, my laptop's got it and I'm enjoying it. So presumably everybody needs NVMe drives. And I think that is what is taking over the data center today. From, you know, its early start in 2014, now I think NVMe is becoming more and more predominant in data center and enterprise storage purchasing cycle.
A lot of people, you know, talk about whether it's needed or not. Obviously, we've got that whole point. And we saw companies at the beginning of the all-flash array market get into trouble of, you know, we're the only people that can provide 1 million IOPS. And then people would say, yeah, but it costs. And what's the benefit of that? So I guess the question back is, to what's the relative price per IOP between all flash arrays and the NVMe world? Is it something that people pay a premium for because they need it, or is there actually not that huge a price difference?
We don't usually quote price per IOPS because it looks suspiciously low because of the IOPS explosion that we can provide.
Yep.
And arguably, some customers will ask, maybe we only need 1 million IOPS, or maybe we only need 2 million IOPS, so all of a sudden the price per IOPS is different. What you need to bear in mind is that just measuring IOPS is not always giving the full picture. There is an IOPS to latency curve, which is really what's interesting, and NVMe pushes that curve dramatically. So what you can get at 1 million or 2 million IOPS, for example, we clock 5 million IOPS at about 300 microseconds. Even when we reach our 10 million IOPS highest performance, it's still about a millisecond. So it's not just about absolute IOPS, but it's really about IOPS to latency and that curve. And many customers will put themselves somewhere around 1 million or 2 million IOPS, but they will get 10 times lower latency at that level of traffic compared to their existing solutions. In terms of cost, we have chosen to completely focus on commodity hardware and commodity drives, commodity network adapters. It is actually very cost effective. So the cost that you get today for E8 storage is roughly on par with all flash arrays that have a tenth of the performance of E8.
Well, that's good.
So I think also betting on the commodity trends is a very important thing, because if you build your own hardware, if you build your own network cards, if you build your own SSDs, you end up competing or losing out on the innovation that the likes of Intel and Samsung and Western Digital and all those guys provide in their SSD. We think that's kind of a losing bet, that the rate of innovation for those guys is so fast that, you know, every 6 months or every 12 months, there's a new generation out of SSDs, and we can enjoy that. So, for example, we've always said that the beauty of the 8th architecture is that it's future compatible for even faster SSDs when those come out.
Yeah.
And indeed, the Intel Optane SSDs, the 3D crossbone-based SSDs, have started being shipped this year, and we use them in our product without modifying anything in our hardware or anything in our software. It's just plug and play because it conforms to the NVMe standard, and so do we.
Yeah, absolutely. It's amazing what people can learn from violin memory and some of the challenges they had. It's the only thing I'll say on that subject.
Let's dig down into some of the architectural components then, because we talked about quite a lot there, and I think it'd be good to go back over it in a bit more of a structured way. So some of the things I can see that are in your architecture and in the architecture of these platforms in general are things like, and I'll use the term parallel processing, so getting away from that centralized controller, but giving a point-to-point connectivity between the client and the storage itself. So that's one thing. The architecture is also sharing drives. So it seems to be that more than one client can be writing to a drive at any one time. And obviously, I guess that's a feature of the NVMe platform. And taking out that controller means you're not binding the performance like we've already talked about. Exactly how are those features working? And is there anything else within the architecture we should be thinking about?
So when we started E8, we've identified that the bottleneck in the all-flash arrays is that they perform all of their computation and all of their storage functions within typically a pair of controllers, or a dual controller, if you will. There is basically two ways to break apart that bottleneck, other than waiting for even faster controllers to be available. One is to build your own hardware and accelerate whatever those two controllers are unable to do through a hardware implementation, which is basically what DSSD did and I have a firm belief that that's a dead-end approach because you're building your own hardware and cannot keep up with the commodity trends. The alternative, if you're using a simple box like we do, which has got the same exact two controllers that any kind of all-flash array would be using today, and the same exact 24 SSDs as any all-flash array would be using, how are we different? If we're sticking to an off-the-shelf approach and doing only software, how do you break the dual controller bottleneck? And the way we've solved it is by literally thinking outside the box and running portions of what typically an all-flash array does inside the box. We actually unload it in the slim software services that we run on the application servers that connect to the E8 storage box.
So you're saying that the client itself is running some of the storage management tasks.
Yes, and given a fast enough network, and NVMe over Fabrics requires such a fast enough network anyway, you wouldn't notice the big difference between running stuff inside the box or running them on those application servers. And specifically, I'm referring to RDMA, which is a network acceleration technique that gives us this kind of performance edge where you don't see much of a difference between running it inside the box or outside the box. And assuming you connect quite a few stations to the E8 box, we support today up to 120 workstations or servers that connect concurrently to a single E8 box, then fanning out the performance this way is actually very cost effective because we can only take up one core out of those dozens of servers and get you that kind of crazy 10 million IOPS performance.
Okay, so we'll talk about the overhead on the client in a little while, but it sounds to me like networking here is a very, very key component compared to what it might be in other platforms. It becomes a bit more of a sensitive component that you have to get right.
Yes and no. I mean, networking is certainly a key point of what we do. We call ourselves E8 storage, but we might as well have called ourselves E8 networking. But when you think of it, getting from the application to the storage and getting that kind of performance is all about the networking. And Fibre Channel doesn't cut it anymore. What will replace Fibre Channel, in our belief, is Ethernet because it's ubiquitous. And anybody doing storage today and attaching to Ethernet is going to face these kinds of challenges. I think we're really at the forerunners of this race to achieve high-performance Ethernet-attached storage. So, yes, certainly networking is part of our mission, but I think it comes with the territory. I don't think it's exactly to do with the E8 architecture necessarily.
You're going to be having a lot of people who are going to be very upset that you said Fibre Channel doesn't cut it anymore because there's a lot of dyed-in-the-wool Fibre Channel fans out there. But I guess one of the things you mean there for a start, without a doubt, is latency and throughput on Ethernet compared to Fibre Channel.
So I think, you know, Fibre Channel, I know that world well from IBM and XFE Storage, which was sold only to Fibre Channel. When I entered XFE 10 years ago, Fibre Channel we used was 4 gigs and Ethernet we used was 1 gig per port. Today, the Fibre Channel, the newest one, and I've never seen anybody actually deploy it, is 32 gigabit. And Ethernet, the ubiquitous and typical top-of-the-rack switch you can buy today for $4,000, has got 100 gig ports. So Ethernet and Fibre Channel have really changed in their speeds and feeds in this decade in a very dramatic fashion. And it's not only that. A single Ethernet 100 gig port cost one-third of what a single Fibre Channel 32 gig port costs when you take into account the cabling, the optics, and all of that stuff. Why would you spend and invest into a second network that's much slower than your primary network? Anybody who's building a modern data center today has already realized that, and that's the kind of customers that we are talking to and catering to. Any kind of traditional Fibre Channel shop that is not going to upgrade its networking and shy away from Fibre Channel is probably not the right market for us. I think that's a shrinking market.
So that brings a question together, which I hear a lot, which is, you mentioned about latency and reducing the latency from the network. There's an argument that says that the storage should even be even more tightly coupled to the server because it's closest to the problem where it exists, so reducing latency. So I've got to ask the question, why is E8 a storage company and not a server company that tightly couples the storage to it? Are you seeing a requirement there for shared space, or is it just something that you don't want to move into in the server world?
So first of all, we're a software company, or more accurately, a systems company. We don't develop hardware.
Good answer.
So I don't think we're going to ever be a server company. I think that there's a lot to be said about local storage and locally attached storage, be it memory or Optane or SSDs. I don't think we have much to provide there, or not much we can innovate there. The need for disaggregated flash is something we're seeing coming from many directions, but there is always going to be faster locally attached RAM or, you know, other technologies that you can use for local storage and things you do not need necessarily redundancy over. So, you know, caching, why put your cache inside the 8 if you can cache locally? I wouldn't make the argument that you should. So E8 is primarily used for the data itself, for the data tier. It allows customers to create a fast new data tier, and there's many applications that really enjoy that, but it only makes sense if you need some sort of disaggregation or sharing. For example, if server A would fail, you still want access to the data, which is something you cannot do with a local storage or local RAM.
That's a good point with the architecture, in the sense that if you do that with nodes that are running in a hyperconverged solution, somehow you still have to spread that data across those nodes, and you still got to protect against memory failure and all the rest of it. So I guess that's the difference, isn't it, I guess, in that scenario between those two architectures.
Yes, I mean, there is a difference between local data that you don't care about if it evaporates, which is what typically would put locally and very close to that processing unit. If you're talking about replicating that data, then it's no longer really that close to the processing unit, because now you need to wait for the replicas to get updated. And in that case, disaggregating and moving it to a shared repository makes sense, because maybe you need less copies now. Maybe you can scale your storage easier now. Maybe you can get more capacity added to the box in a more friendly manner. There's many different directions that are leading customers to choose that. And we're also seeing that the big guys, the Googles and Amazons of the world, are going into that direction a lot and pushing NVMe over Fabrics precisely because of that, to allow adding storage in one point that is consumed by computer applications at another point.
Sivan, let's go down and discuss your platform and your architecture in a bit more detail. Why don't you take us through exactly what your product is, what that you offer, what the architecture looks like, so people can get an understanding of what the actual platform is.
Okay, so E8 is a clean slate architecture designed for NVMe drives and built in a disaggregated fashion. So the application servers are remoted from the boxes containing the storage. The networking between the application servers and those boxes must be RDMA-enabled. We're focused today on RoCE, which is RDMA over converged Ethernet, but we do have plans to support other RDMA fabrics as well. The box itself is commodity. It's basically any kind of x86 server with NVMe drives. The appliance we've productized is a two-node, 224 kind of appliance, very typical and similar to existing SAS or SATA kind of hard drive and SSD enclosures. And in that appliance, we have two controllers for high availability and resiliency that connect through up to 8 100 gig ports to typically the top of the rack Ethernet switch or a couple of switches for redundancy. In that sense, the data path of E8 is as fast and as efficient as can possibly be, because it goes directly from the application server through one hop on the network, or if the customer chooses to extend the network larger than that, it's his choice, but it goes almost directly from the application server to the SSDs. And within the box, it basically the data path itself is not getting processed at all. It goes almost directly to the SSDs.
So let me just touch on that for a second. So the client itself has what installed in it? What does the client need to have, the client server? So
any box that talks to E8 storage needs to install our agent service, which is a Linux agent service that runs. And basically, it creates the effect for that machine as if you've added more local SSDs to it. It masquerades the fact that those SSDs are actually remote and virtual SSDs carved out of a shared pool on the E8 box. And yes. That service is basically, it shows up as regular block devices on your Linux box. It translates the block device IOs into networking IOs towards the remote box.
Okay, so you've got a client that runs some code that does that block device emulation. You're writing across the network in a very low overhead, short number of hops directly to an NVMe device. Clearly, the client knows exactly which particular block or blocks on the NVMe device it's talking to, so that doesn't go through any intermediate control process in order to get it onto that NVMe device?
Yeah, so the main intellectual property of V8 and the secret sauce here is how exactly to create that state so that the agents can access those SSDs directly, and how to create a split between control path and data path, which is something that is, when we started out, it felt very natural for us, because if you think of it in the world of networking and in the world of telephony, separation of control path and data path has been in existence for, you know, decades. But in storage, it hasn't really been the case. And if you look at the data sheet of an SSD or a hard drive, it supports maybe 100 commands, but it doesn't tell you this command is a data path command, this command is a control path command. It's all fused together. So we needed to scratch our heads hard and think, how do you create such a control path to data path split, and how do you synchronize the whole thing? And that's the E8 architecture, and that's where the innovation and intellectual property of E8 lies. We've been granted already almost 10 patents for E8 and a few more pending just on the nature of that architecture. And basically, once you create such a split between control path and data path, the agents can talk directly to the SSDs and only get control path updates or communications to the centralized controller for synchronization, or, for example, new volume creation. You need to tell the hosts that are interested in that volume exists at all. So that's some sort of coordination effort that needs to take place between those agents and the centralized server.
Right. So you've got a centralized management controller that's storing the data that says what every single physical drive maps to in terms of a logical drive, and the clients gain access to that data so that the client knows when it writes to a logical drive on the host exactly which physical NVMe drive it should be writing to and where.
Exactly. And those couple of metadata servers, out of convenience, we are keeping them inside the box on the two controllers. So the two controllers we have in the box actually serve two functions. One is they translate from Ethernet to PCIe. So think of them as highly available switches to achieve access from the customer's Ethernet network to a bunch of NVMe drives. The other function is to act as highly available metadata servers that the agents running on the application servers can talk to and coordinate through. And given the fact that we have RDMA, we're able to make very efficient and low impact transactions between those servers and the two controllers. And that's the kind of split we do between control path and data path.
So I'm going to ask you some, I guess, slightly trickier questions in terms of how this works, really just trying to dig down into more detail. And the reason for asking that question is, as you look at a traditional architecture, one of the tasks that the controllers did was that they would be the point through which data services were delivered. So if you were implementing, say, snapshots or date protection, or in modern architectures, things like dedupe, that process would be controlled by those controllers, because firstly, they owned the metadata that mapped the logical to physical relationship going from the host to the actual backend disks. But also they would manipulate that metadata when the host then did a query. So in your disaggregated architecture, how do you implement features like snapshots and data protection and so on?
Our architecture is more complicated than a dual controller. I think that much is certain. And every feature we do, we need to think of this new architecture and cast the feature onto it and figure out what needs to run inside the controllers and what needs to run on those extensions or, you know, agents. And it varies from feature to feature. And also sometimes we change our mind. And actually, the fact that we run software on both sides of the communication makes it simple to make such changes. So the idea is, the design goal is that the data path runs entirely on the application servers and the control path runs entirely on the two metadata servers, but it's not always possible. And of course, there is a discussion on what is control path and what is data path to begin with. In the case of snapshots, the decision we took is that we do not store volatile metadata on the application servers. So those application servers, even though we took the liberty of running some of our software on them, there's nothing really guaranteeing their continued liveliness, to put it this way. It's not really ours to own. So if a customer server were to fail, what do we do now? So we took the approach that is very resiliency centric, that we can make no assumptions on those application servers. And in fact, they might all fail concurrently, for example, because of a networking malfunction or a power outage. So we never store any kind of volatile metadata on the application servers. And the volatile metadata, for example, for snapshots, is only stored on the controllers. Having said that, it's not necessarily the case. Given RDMA, we have direct access to the controller's memory, so we can carve it out to different sections for those agents to be able to access directly. It's just that their shared RAM metadata is kept in that safe place, and they access it remotely.
Let me just touch on that point, because that's really quite an interesting one. So what you're saying is, because you're using RDMA to talk to not just the NVMe drives, but to your controllers, then the actual access to metadata from the client's perspective is also accelerated, because it goes across that same very, very fast network.
Exactly. And that's a key point that without WIFT we'd be extremely handicapped and would not achieve the same kind of performance.
So I think that might not be as obvious to people when they look at the architecture, to think that when you've disaggregated the hosts in some respect and pushed out some of that responsibility to the client to do some of that work, the fact that the clients still have access to that shared memory sitting on the management controllers, they can still access it at the speed that and with the synchronicity that they could do if it was all a centralized function. So you're not actually necessarily taking an overhead or an impact by disaggregating that workload.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, the proof is in the pudding. And recently we've started working and publishing benchmarks, and the numbers are just astounding. The theory one can argue with, but the actual empirical tests are astonishing. And we are achieving a performance that beats DSSD, the formerly product known as DSSD, with commodity hardware. That's just crazy. And it's exactly because of that. It's because the network is fast enough to allow us to do such tricks. And when we started E8, I was really bothered by a very simple question. Why now? It was 2014. A bunch of people out of Israel have come up with the new architecture for storage. It sounds kind of ludicrous. And it took us a long time to realize that the reason that we can do E8 in the first place is due to two hardware enablers. One is NVMe drives, and the second is fast RDMA networks, particularly the 100 gig Ethernet, which has become ubiquitous. And when you think of it, NVMe drives only started coming out in late 2014, and 100 gig Ethernet networks and NICs only started coming out in late 2014 too. So the hardware enablers for us are NVMe drives and 100 gig networks, and that's what allows us to do E8. And that's why it was not possible to do that before, because when you think of it, it makes a lot of sense to do the network path, the control path and data path separation and abstraction, but it was never done for block storage before. It was not needed at the speeds and feeds of hard drives. And all the all-flash arrays have basically piggybacked on the existing hard drive piping, namely SATA and SAS. It is only NVMe that really broke that age-old tradition of SCSI.
Some products have tried to separate data path and control path. So although without doing it in the real sense, things like Viper from EMC were trying to talk to the concept, but they weren't actually in any way delivering to the actual technology of doing it properly.
It's a very subtle way of wording that, Chris.
Yeah. Was that a nice way of putting it? Without
It was very good.
That was probably the nicest way I could have said that. And I guess there are other vendors who've tried something similar of splitting that data and control path. But as you said, possibly now until the technology was there to do it properly, the implementations haven't been there in the way that you can do it today.
So Zivan, what about data protection within the box?
We have focused on doing RAID 6 within the box. We support RAID 6, RAID 5, RAID 10, and RAID 0. It's all software RAID done at the application server service. We never store the volatile metadata on the application server, so we are resilient to any fault. You can lose one or two SSDs in case of RAID 6. You can lose any number of network paths. You can lose one of the controllers. You can lose the power, and you can knock out all the application servers, even though we run our software on all of them, and still nothing happens to your storage. That's been a very key premise for E8 in terms of resiliency to any possible fault. So the beauty of using off-the-shelf hardware is that you get the refresh cycles and innovation coming from those large vendors. The short side of it is you don't really have control over that hardware. And if it fails, it's on us. We need to be, you know, we need to own that, and we need to take responsibility over that. And that is what we do, and that's why we have such resiliency in place. To date, all of our production systems have been installed with RAID 6. That is what customers have asked for. I think existing all-flash arrays have kind of set RAID 6 as table stakes for SSDs. Whether or not it's needed mathematically is no longer an argument. It just is.
It's interesting. I was going to pick you up on that because, you know, RAID 6 really come around when people like NetApp started doing large-scale SATA implementations that saw high failure rates. I've certainly not seen failure rates that high in SSD, and certainly not in the NVMe drives, certainly in the dual-ported ones. Is that something you see changing? It's interesting that you picked up that the customers were demanding on RAID 6, because my immediate reaction to you saying that was that's overkill.
I think the failures of hard drives, you know, I've spent 5 years. I've shipped over 1 million hard drives that I had to wake up at night to if they failed. So the failure of hard drives is very different from the failure of SSDs, but the failures are there. And what people are mostly afraid of is all sorts of chain reactions, that if one SSD fails, then maybe another one is forthcoming. And that's what's made RAID 6 kind of mandatory. With the performance we give to our customers today with RAID 6, I don't think they really have any reason to choose the lesser options. We do provide them, so sometimes people do ask about that. So we also have RAID 5 and RAID 10 and RAID 0.
Okay.
But all of our production systems are with RAID 6. Our D24 appliance has got high availability, so it supports any kind of fault at the controller level or at the network level. We thought that's a very kind of basic thing for customers. And indeed, all the customers bought the 8, have bought the highly available flavor. We also have a 1U10 without high availability, but there's less of an interest in it because it doesn't have high availability. So we feel that was very well justified, the investment and expense into dual port NVMe drives. We are today the first and, to the best of our knowledge, only product in market with dual port NVMe drives. We support dual port NVMe drives from all vendors that will manufacture them. Today, there's three such vendors that we support, and we will pick the right flavor for the customer application based on their performance profile and capacity requirements. We are also support dual port Optane drives. Again, we're the first, and to the best of our knowledge, only product in the industry to do that. We think there is a very good future for that kind of high performance flavor as well.
So I don't know if anybody else is using Optane, but there are other products out there that are using the dual ported drives at the moment. I wouldn't say they're using to your design. So we know of the XIO Accelio product. That's a server rather than a storage box, but that uses the dual-ported drive. So there are others out there, but certainly from an Optane point of view, yeah, you're first to market there. So it's interesting you mentioned customers a few times there. What does a typical EH customer look like?
We found the traction with a few different markets. First and foremost, it's financials and market data analytics, real-time trading. Those applications have a very high demand for performance in storage. That has been our initial market and our initial footprint. One of the nice stories we tell is that the customer was using local SSDs for their data. And when they try to move to an all-flash array or to a NAS system, they discover they get a tenth of the latency compared to local. So as SSDs have become dramatically cheaper, they chose to simply copy over the data from server to server and populate the servers with enough local SSD capacity to cover for it. And they just bought thousands of SSDs to achieve just that. And what we were able to show them is a 70 server to 1 consolidation ratio from local SSDs to shared NVMe. And because the performance of NVMe is so high, and we're able to dish it out to those 70 servers accessing E8 in tandem, we're able to displace 70 SSDs with a single copy. So it's not actually 70 SSDs. It's actually something like 500 or 600 SSDs displaced by a box of 24. The beauty of that story is not just about the consolidation play, but it actually allowed them to increase the data set from the amount of capacity that their servers could could swallow up, which was about 10 terabyte or 15 terabyte, to an E8 box, which today is about 150 terabyte. So they could increase their data set tenfold in a very affordable way and dish that out to anything from 40 to 100 servers.
Listening to your responses there, it sounds as though a lot of what customers are looking for is a business advantage rather than just reducing cost. It's about, you know, enabling applications that, that necessarily couldn't be used or deployed fast enough for them in the past. Is that true to say?
Yeah, yeah, certainly. And the hunt is for those applications. We're seeing a lot of interest in real-time analytics. I think one of the nice things about faster storage, it's not only about displacing something existing, it's more about enabling something new. Any kind of application that's running today on your iPhone or smartphone is accessing some sort of huge database and is also collecting information about you, and all the queries you put onto those websites are themselves turned into data. And accessing that data, crunching that data, requires real-time analytics and real-time performance. And that's the kind of applications that we're after that are enabled by faster storage. And usually our greenfield deployments with a large room for scaling and growing capacity. And we find a lot of interest there. Another market for us is large websites or, you know, the web scale data center, not Amazon or Google, but anybody who is slightly smaller than them is still building their own data center and requires fast storage for hot data or for their fast databases. And that's a growing market for us.
It's interesting now, some of the points you raised about the markets you're playing in. A wise old sage many, many years ago, when I was at EMC, said to me, nobody ever buys storage, they buy a solution. To that point, I'm guessing that a lot of your business is coming through software providers that you're working with to help them show the real benefits of their software. You mentioned financial analytics, and I can see you've partnered with some people you mentioned on your website, such as KX. Is that a route to market for you through those software guys, or is it tending to still be the end users buying your equipment?
It's a mix. I mean, doing startup sales is somewhat different than IBM or EMC sales. I've been learning. I think that you need to light up both lights for the sale to happen. One is there is an application or a software vendor, as you say, that really enjoys or benefits from having this kind of storage. And two, that the customer has got an application and has got a business need that will be dramatically accelerated. If we don't provide the 10x performance kick, they will not be talking to a startup. They will rather buy from the incumbents and the large guys.
Absolutely.
Luckily for us, that's exactly what we do. We've had a customer that was already convinced that they need and want to buy E8, but their procurement completely stalled the deal and told them, you know, we work with the name large vendor A and we work with name large vendor B and we only buy storage from them. So we've never heard of E8. So they forced this customer to run a bake-off between vendor A, vendor B, and E8. And not surprisingly, we got 10 times their performance because that's what our data sheet says compared to their data sheet. There was no real mystery there. But it was only through that that procurement was convinced that they don't have a choice. It's not, so as you say, it's not about performance. Can the applications enjoy the performance boost? And how does it lead to business results? So it could be in the case of market data, instead of looking at 3 months market data, because we run 10 times faster, you can now look at 30 months market data. In the case of websites, it could be reactivity of the website or reactivity of transactional processing. You know, how long does it take for a credit card to get swiped? These are, you know, basic things that customers are measuring and they can see the improvement with their eyes. If we give them a performance kick that their applications cannot enjoy and cannot consume, then, you know, they don't care. And also when we talk to customers, a lot of it is not about NVMe and NVMe over fabrics and all of that. They really don't care. Do you think they care if a box has got NVMe drives or SATA drives in it? It could be a lump of coal for all they care. They're just measuring the performance. They're measuring the resiliency, maybe the power consumption, cost, things like that. So all this marketing, I don't get all this marketing that the big guys are doing about NVMe and not showing the performance results. The only thing the customers care about is the performance, and they don't care at all about the underlying drive.
Well, I think that's a lot of it is that there's a lot of people out there making success through marketing rather than some of the technical gains. And I think that's a fair way to put it, rather subtly.
That's a good point.
So the question we ask of all vendors that come onto this, and most of them invariably hate, is what's next? Without you revealing, you know, some great secrets, where do you see some of the future challenges for E8, and where do you see you guys growing into further spaces?
I think what we're seeing now is the move from buying, you know, 2-3 boxes to larger deployments. We have not seen a customer that is enjoying E8 that doesn't want to buy a lot. That requires somewhat different feature set in terms of aggregation of boxes and single pane management that we're going to GA later. And it also requires a higher duty cycle in terms of manageability and RAS that when you sell 2 or 3 boxes are necessarily as key. It's really about maturization of the technology of the product and the entire sale to deploy and maintain cycle. That's what our focus has been on recently. I mean, you know, when you install 2 boxes, you can send a guy over there and he'll do it. If they're now ordering 20 boxes, you need to find some other way to do it. Pure Storage had an awesome demo where they had a 9-year-old kid of one of the employees perform an install of Pure Storage in 30 minutes. So
it does
set the bar. You know, we were looking for 9-year-olds that can install and deploy NVMe over fabrics. And that's, I think that's the goal, really, to be at that kind of level of simplicity and ease of use.
So Zivan, that was great. That was really, really useful information. I'm hoping that people have really sort of absorbed some of the real technical discussions we've had there, but also the really interesting thing about the sort of customers and the sort of applications that the technology is being used for and being applied to. So once again, thanks for joining us. And hopefully we can get to talk to you in a little while once you're on that next stage further down the line. And we can hear what's coming up with the new stuff.
Thanks you, Chris and Gavin. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate your time.
Wonderful. Okay. Well, that's it, everybody. Thanks for joining us again for this podcast. As ever, you can catch us online at storageunpacked.com. You can catch us on the Twitters at Storage Unpacked. And you can catch us on the LinkedIn group by doing a search for the Storage Unpacked podcast. Thanks very much. Cheers, guys.